From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Ethical, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and games development. I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy. I, too, make nice games.
In this episode, we talk with Sam Liberty, applied game design consultant and gamification expert, to discuss dark design patterns in games. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Welcome to the clubhouse, Sam.
Thank you for having me.
So I am very excited that you're here because I got to attend a talk that you did for Serious Play 2025. Listeners might remember the episode, the special episode that I did and talked with Ellen with. And it very much sunk its roots into me, both professionally and personally. Thinking a lot about gamification, but then also reward structures. And then even just, you know, finding out It kind of crystallized for me something that I tacitly noticed or understood to, and started having words to put to it. Things like the fact that, you know, apps like dating apps are designed to be kind of predatorily compulsive. Ooh, and yeah. Stuff like, yeah.
I can tell you that now.
Yeah, I've seen it with my friends. Mm-hmm. And just kind of getting a sense of like of what exists in the world of design that feels not right. So I'm really excited to get to dig into this a little bit more and get more of that crystallization, if possible.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Oh, we're already getting the questions to us. Oh, okay.
Sorry, I'm a professor, so sometimes I like to ask questions. But you mentioned that the talk grabbed you and made you look at things differently. I'm curious if it changed your approach as a game dev at all.
Ooh. I don't know if it's changed anything, but it's certainly just because in general, I really want to lean into more intrinsic motivation, and I am personally not very motivated by things like numbers and streaks and high scores. So that's already something that like I rub against because it's like, well, why? I don't know. It's not that compelling. Why should I put this in a game for no good reason, quote unquote? But it definitely shaped how I have to how I think about if I'm asked to make a reward system or if I'm asked to try and add some form of external motivation or if some other way to, you know, entice people to keep logging in. That has certainly shaped that thought besides, ugh, this feels weird, or ugh, why do I have to do this?
Yeah.
In a way that is very it both feels like a better place to start, but it also is a more weighty responsibility, right? Because I understand now it's not just a high score, it's not just a streak. Like that is something that is you're building a behavior or an ideal wanted behavior into the player, into the game.
Yeah, exactly. When I'm playing games and I notice these tacked on systems, I often feel it's easy enough to ignore them usually. But things like having bizarre achievements attached to it that take a long time to do,
yeah.
And I would never do otherwise. It's like, well, why would I do that? But I know there's the kind of person out there that just loves 100%ing things and getting all the achievements,
mm-hmm.
and it's there for that, and maybe they get some enjoyment out of it. But I rarely meet this person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah. I love that we started the conversation right out the gate, but maybe we jumped the gun a little bit.
100%.
Sam, can you introduce yourself to listeners who maybe haven't heard of you?
So I'm Sam Liberty. Like Lydia said, I am an applied game designer consultant, and I'm an expert in gamification. I kind of started down this path around 2012 when I became a game designer at a place called the Engagement Lab at Emerson College.
Mm.
Back then, it was called the Engagement Game Lab. That's in Boston.
Yep.
It dropped the game, and then after I left some years later, it's now been shut by Emerson. But while I was there, basically we were developing games for civic engagement and researching them. So how do you get people to volunteer responsibly? How do you get people to take part in civic processes like city planning?
Mm-hmm.
And we used games to make those more meaningful and inclusive to people that would normally would not normally be part of that process. Because if you've ever gone to like a city meeting, like it's mostly like old retired people. Mm-hmm. But that quickly expanded and became a lot of work with humanitarian organizations like the Red Cross Climate Center, like the World Wildlife Fund, the World Bank as well. And I got to kind of learn to design these things by designing them and working with stakeholders in really diverse populations, like Ghana, Bhutan, Egypt, mm-hmm. And kind of figuring out on my own, like what worked and what didn't, and kind of inventing some processes that maybe if I had been formally trained, I would have understood a little bit better before it happened. But getting into human-centered design, like what I now know is UX research, qualitative research, and game design, and kind of applying the best skills I knew how to make that work. After that, I became a consultant doing a lot of the same work, and a teacher at Northeastern University, also in Boston, and later became the lead game designer at a company called Sidekick Health. That's in Iceland. They're a digital therapeutic, which means that they are a therapy, so all of their software needs to be proven in clinical trial to be effective.
Okay.
Believe it or not, there's actually not a lot of good research around game mechanics in behavior change. And I'm actually editing a book right now. We're trying to call it Games and Behavior Change, and pulling in different authors to write chapters. And every time I meet somebody, and I'm like, well, do you have proven behavior change? Do you have data? And the vast majority of them don't.
Oh, dang.
Because, well, there's reasons for that. We can get into them if you'd like. I'm trying to get through my bio here and taking a lot of something.
It's all good.
At Sidekick, I learned a lot about behavioral science.
Okay.
And when I did that, I could look back on my previous work, the stuff that we did get the chance to measure and get data for, and say, okay, well, these ones worked and these ones didn't. And we never quite knew why, but retroactively applying the behavioral frameworks to them, it's like, oh, well, these ones that worked line up with the behavioral frameworks. Mm-hmm. These ones that don't line up with phony baloney frameworks that have no evidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, I guess like one of my side passions is trying to get behavioral science and game design to like have a baby, and that baby will be actually effective and ethical gamification.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the process of this, right? It's like you can't just claim that this thing works ethically without actual evidence to back that up. Otherwise, you're just saying that as a marketing
scheme. Yeah.
So that's an important aspect of it.
It also, just tying into the topic of this particular episode, it strikes me as something that is easier to identify and explain when it is bad than how to define and explain why it works if it's good.
Yeah.
I don't know if that is another layer of just that we humans have negativity bias, or if it's something more palpably strong, but it sounds very similar, and something that you have to think about in tandem as well.
Yeah. And I think like there are a lot of good positive examples of games out there that do things ethically. But like maybe it's not that sexy to talk about them. Maybe we'll be. I don't know. I think we can get into some examples. I think in my talk, Lydia, I showed Stardew Valley and compared it to Genshin Impact.
Mm.
And kind of contrasted the addictive nature of both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Why one I consider ethical and one unethical in its design patterns.
Mm-hmm. And then when we split into groups, my group in particular also broke down Farmville and why. Oh, wow. Yeah, talking about Farmville and why that was distinctly unethical. And trying to figure that out
in a long time,
right?
I didn't see this talk, so maybe both of you can kind of frame both with what makes Genshin and Farmville different from Stardew, because I have thoughts about addictive gameplay independent of monetization, but it sounds like the difference is monetization.
Well, I think, yeah, explain what is a dark design pattern and then bring that into how does that show up in games?
So a dark pattern basically the easiest way to explain it is a design pattern that compels or encourages a user to take an action that is not in their best interest.
Okay.
That is in the best interest of the company making the product, usually a financial interest. I think that's clear enough.
Yeah. Okay. So it does oftentimes, it does sound like Mark was saying, it is oftentimes a monetization issue.
But like not limited to
But not yeah, limited yeah, to yeah. it. Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could all, yeah, it's, I think these things are tied together. Like I think companies rarely want users to take actions that are not in the company's bottom line interest.
Yeah.
But when you look at, so the reason that I chose Stardew Valley and Genshin Impact is these are both games that my students tell me they spend hundreds of hours on.
Sure.
Right. Or sometimes a thousand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And while there must be something really compelling about these games, if people are spending this many hours on them, well, what is so compelling? And when you look at Stardew Valley, it's a game that you buy once, you've paid for it, and then it's compelling because there's so much content, and the gameplay loop is so strong, and there's a lot of surprise built into it about what might happen throughout the season, and you really want to make sure that your crops don't fail, and you feel a responsibility to that and all of this stuff. But the user taking all of these actions, like a user that plays 1,000 hours of this game and the user that plays 1 hour of this game, are equally good for the developer's bottom line. They don't need you to be compelled to play it. I guess what they really want you to do is like it so much that you talk about it and tell your friends to play it and give a good review on Steam and all this other stuff, right?
Yeah.
So you're not exploiting them by taking their time. You're selling them a product, which then they get a lot of enjoyment out of. Whereas with Genshin, well, that's free, right? That's it's a free game, quote unquote. But then once you start playing it, all of these compulsive patterns encourage you basically every second that you're playing it to fess up some money. So for those of you that don't know Genshin, it's a gacha game, which is named after a Japanese prize machine where you put in money and then get a little toy out of. And the main mechanic of the game is that you open up packs of characters, weapons, and things like that, and they have different rarities, and you can technically earn packs just by playing the game and grinding. But then Genshin does this thing, the sleight of hand, where they're like, well, you've just spent 3 hours playing this game to get a pack. Or this small amount of money, you can guarantee a rare from this pack. Which was that, how much, when you think about, okay, how much is 3 hours of your time worth? Right? A lot more than $5. So they do this shell game where like, oh, well, you wouldn't normally pay $5 for this thing. But because it's turned into 3 hours of your time in your mind, you're actually paying to make 3 hours of your time valuable. So, okay, I will do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to mention the fact that there's all of these slot machine like elements to it where you pull and there's a lot of great animations and all that to make it feel great when you open it. Just like Las Vegas.
It's very reminiscent of the loot box era of games.
No, we're back into that, actually.
Oh, no, we are?
Yeah.
But, okay. Well,
what I find interesting about that is it's often seen, it's often said between gamers, like, well, you can pay for it, but if you just grind it out, you can get it for free. And like, that's, you know, it's maybe not ideal, but like, you can do that. But the way you're framing it is by putting a value on it based on your time, that actually is critical to the pattern.
Yeah.
Whereas if you could only get it by paying for it, it would actually probably not sell as well because there is no value attached. There's no intrinsic value that you can compare it to.
Yeah, from my understanding, a lot of these kinds of games, and actually, I would love to hear your insight on this, Sam. A lot of these kinds of games have a bunch of different types of currencies mm-hmm. that will get you different things in the game that are very difficult for the human brain to conceptualize how much that actually costs. Yeah. Like, we know what $5 means, but it's difficult to know what $5 means, but that gets converted into 2,000 win bucks, which also transfers into an extra skin for a character or whatever, and that conversion is difficult for humans to really interpret what that actually costs.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. You're taking the money that's real money and turning it into funny money that has no meaning anymore.
Yeah.
And like this is again like a trick that Las Vegas uses to make your money disappear. And like it used to be you buying chips.
Right.
But now everything is on a card, and if you want to play the slot machines, which are probably the worst thing to play, so like your money turns into like wampum or something, and then or points, and you just watch it disappear and it doesn't feel as bad because you're not capturing the money, you're not serving the money.
Yeah.
But what you say is really endemic in game design these days because everything has all these funny currencies. I think in one example in my talk, I talked about Clash of Clans having like more than 8.
Wow.
There's coins, there's gems, there's builder coins, there's elixirs, like all these things that you can pay actual money for, but at all different exchange rates. And one of the worst offenders is actually Roblox, because first you change your money into Robux.
Yeah.
Which has a weird calculation that isn't even consistent day to day all the time. And then when you go to play one of these games that you can spend things on, you're not actually spending the Robux. You're converting the Robux into currency for that specific game. And each game has their own. So it's like, well, how much is 2 billion coins worth?
Yeah.
How much is 100 million gems worth? I'm like I'm not exaggerating. Those are how big the numbers are.
Yeah.
So I took $20 and turned it into 3,600 Robux and then turned those into 1 billion gems and the money is gone.
Yeah. Right. The inflation of numbers also is an obscuring tactic itself. I mean, I love games that have heart canisters because it's very clear, like, I have a heart, I have health, I don't have health. Whereas if it's a number, especially if it's in hundreds or thousands, it's like, I don't know how many hits I can take.
Right.
Because of that unit or resource conversion too.
Yeah, it obfuscates the original conversion, right, of the dollars.
Yeah.
Or whatever your local, you know, proper currency is. But it also puts you in that world. It reframes the value so that the developer gets to decide what has value and how much.
Mm-hmm.
So I think obfuscation sounds like it's one half of it, but maybe not the full story.
No.
Right?
Yeah. But I guess the bottom line is that this particular pattern is about like reducing your attachment to your money and confusing you about what things cost. So you spend more than you meant to or buy things that you wouldn't normally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
I want to go back a little bit. We don't have to spend a lot on this, but it's one of my particular hangups that I always want to make sure gets mentioned is going back to the idea that Stardew costs a certain amount of money, and even though it's very addicting, there's no exploitation there. The developer gets the same amount of money from you as they do from someone for. I think that's true. They get the same amount of money from that customer.
Yes,
but I think one of the things that I think goes unnoticed. And I want to hear your thoughts on this because I think monetization is where it's obvious and where the greatest harms are. I think that's pretty clear. But at the same time, the most best-selling games on Steam are the ones that people pour thousands of hours into.
Yeah.
And part of the reason for that is when someone pours thousands of hours into something and it becomes their hobby, they are now effective word of mouth.
Mm.
And that has a direct financial advantage to that developer. It's indie developers are told all the time, you need games that are sticky, that can be played forever and ever, that get a play time on Steam. That's how you get success. And if you think about it in these terms of monetization, you're like, well, doesn't the value per dollar really, per play time really reduce for me? Don't I want to make more money the more someone plays a game? And actually, it seems like in reality, that is true if you build those models. But it's also true to really subvert that, because that can lead, because there are just so many customers.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of want to hear your thoughts on, because I worry about that, about people making $1,000 games that cost $5 and never a penny more. I worry about that as well. Mm. Is that a theoretical concern of mine, or is that a genuine concern, do you think?
Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure. Generally, I think when you produce a lot of content and then you sell it to somebody, like, that's a value add, right? Like, that's a value proposition.
Yeah.
And I mean, something that people complain about is that a game is too short. Mm-hmm. Whether it's fair or not, people want to get value for money, especially gamers, who the ideal price is nothing. So I think if you can say, hey, if you pay me $24 on Steam, $24.99 on Steam, you will get 300 hours of content. That sounds like a good deal. Right. And if I'm going to be gaming anyway, and I have limited budget, like, this kind of thing is appealing.
Sure.
Like, if I'm telling other people to play a game, it's because I like it. Right. And I feel that I'm getting value from it. So I think the idea that one of the jobs of a game developer is to give an experience to the player that is so enjoyable and so fun that they want to talk about it and tell others about it, and that there's something to talk about, mm-hmm. right? Like, because, okay, you could imagine a game that I've spent 1,000 hours on because I'm compelled to play it. I can also imagine a game that I've spent 1,000 hours on because there's a lot of different strategies I could try,
yeah.
and there's a lot of dialogue, and there's a lot of characters and secrets to explore. And every time it's a little bit different or whatever, right? And these are the things that gamers value in games.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, I've spent, I don't even know how many hours on Hades and Hades 2, and I don't regret that. And I would recommend it to anyone.
Sure.
And when I'm on Reddit and I read somebody's build strategy and how they got 10,000 damage on a hit, I'm like, cool, right? Mm-hmm. I'm happy to talk about it and read about it. And I don't think there's anything exploitative in it.
What counts, like, is content, right? Like, if it's 1,000 hours of content, then it's just a really good value.
Yeah.
But if it's 1,000 hours of dopamine hits from a small amount of content, it's maybe not so valuable. But, yeah. like, you know, what is that line even?
Yeah, right? And I want to emphasize the idea of, like, exploitation in this, because I think that that is maybe the distinction here. Because I agree with you, Mark, in that, like,
My hang up is that we narrowed exploitation to money and money alone.
Right. I agree. Because I think that you can exploit people's time.
Yeah.
You can exploit people's efforts. And I think that is still relevant. But I think that I do think that, like, there is kind of a distinction, and I think part of it is, a lot of it is just, like, the intention, the value that the player gets out of it and the value that the developer gets out of it. Word of mouth is a value, and it is something that people want.
Yeah.
It's something that a developer wants.
And also, I mean, like, I would pay $50 for a good solitaire game.
Yeah.
That's just the same game over and over again.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily what is quote-unquote content is not, you know, I don't want to draw a hard line on that.
Yeah,
that's why I don't want to spend a ton of time on
it. For
this.
Sure, for sure.
But the exploitation is, it's so easy to define when it's like microtransactions, right?
Maybe we should talk about a game like Brawl Stars.
Okay.
So that's a mobile game. It's free, and you can play it unlimited without paying anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really popular because the game is fun. It has recognizable patterns. The graphics are good, and it's a competitive game.
Yeah,
where you get put into rooms and then you fight other people. So there's always a great challenge there.
Yeah.
And where the company makes their money from is by selling skins and seasonal passes,
mm-hmm.
right? So every hour or minute that your players are in that system playing for free is an opportunity to capture them and upsell them into a product.
It's more ad service, ultimately.
Yeah.
And they're constantly producing more content, just like, you know, Fortnite and everything, so that players will want to, well, what's the skin this month, right? You can never have everything you want, because all the time, it's a live service game, and all the time a new thing has been added. And now if you don't have that thing, well, then you're not as cool as the people that have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's, like, I think this is a gray area where they've produced a good product that has value and people like playing it. But then the way they make their money is by kind of pressuring people into spending to look better and to have nicer things. Or I believe this is a game where you can actually buy upgraded gear as well, but I'm not positive on that.
Okay. Yeah, and then you have developers, artists, literally making content, putting work hours into a thing and selling it. So it just feels so uncomplicated. But then when it's the design to get you to buy those things, I think, you know, we're 20 years out from horse armor. But I think gamers have now kind of decided that cosmetics are fine and pay to win is bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's interesting how people are very comfortable with it because they can kind of see this is $5. Someone put time into making it. And they kind of stop their calculations there.
Yeah.
But just the way you described it, it's like, oh, is that even content? Like it's like a mill is what it is.
Yeah. And I think
exactly,
it's also very clearly a luxury item or a superficial item. Sure. It is not, if it's not mechanically advantageous or it doesn't bar gameplay and it is something that is just for funsies. I think there is also that sense of, you know, this is optional and I am in full control of deciding I want it because I don't need it.
They're ignoring the social mechanics that Sam is describing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a way to sneak it in. And that, I guess that's what's dark about it.
Yeah. And it could be that some people are just like, I really want this for me. But a lot of times it's, I want the social status of having had it. Mm-hmm. And they may not even realize that that's it.
It's also pushed very hard in the UI, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the first thing you see. Like there's a big section in the bottom UI for it. I'm not positive on this, but I think you can grind some of the stuff out as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's doing a little bit more of that same sleight of hand as Genshin, even though it's not giving you a random pack or anything that ridiculous. Again, I think this is a gray area. I'm not saying that. Like, I'm not trying to shame the devs of Brawl Stars or anything like that. Clearly they make more money if they push people into upselling them into the skins.
Yeah. Well, and even in an example, like it doesn't necessarily have to be something financially predatory. It can just be like this game, you play it a bunch. I play Blueprints still.
Yeah.
it's a very fun game and I do not regret my decision to continue to play it. But I mean, I am playing it a lot still.
Yeah. It's engineered you to not regret it.
Yeah. And so I want to ask about this from like a developer perspective, because like that is something that can feel troubling. Games in general were in the DNA of games is like slot machines and stuff. That's why arcade machines existed, is so people could keep putting coins into it, and that just spread into our console games and into PC games, and it's just all over the culture now, in a way that is troubling. And we're trying to deal with it, but I don't know that we've gotten to that point. I'm wondering if, as developers, if there's something we can do to recognize some of these patterns that we might be adding into our games, even, not from a predatory perspective, but just,
oh yeah, because games are just made this way.
Yeah,
I like games like this. I'll make games like this. How do you check yourself?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I think that's a really great question, and I actually come across this frequently in my role as a gamification consultant, because companies are like, well, we need to make our app sticky, or I need to make it a daily ritual, because these apps live and die by their churn rate.
Yeah.
And if a user doesn't log in every day, they churn.
Right.
So, well, what do we do? And then they say, okay, well, what's the most popular, successful gamification that's out there right now? And they look around and it's like, oh, look, Duolingo has the streak.
Right.
And so clear. And it's an easy thing to development wise. It's an easy thing to add a streak into an app. So it's a slam dunk, but you're doing a thing just because another app is doing it.
Yeah.
And you're not stopping to think, well, how does the user feel about this feature? Right.
Yeah.
And, although you might be a user might be proud of a Duolingo streak, they feel compelled to log in, not because they're getting value from the product, but because they don't want to lose something.
Yes.
You're triggering loss aversion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of live service games have something like that, like a daily gift or some use streaks, or because they know that they live and die by users logging on every day. So they push that as hard as they can. And well, who doesn't like getting a gift? Mm-hmm. Come on and get it. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm offering you a gift. But it's like a scratch off ticket, basically.
Yeah.
And you open up and you get something. And if you don't log in, you're losing that opportunity. So are you logging in because you want to play, or are you logging in because you don't want to lose an opportunity?
Or
that you become addicted to that hit of opening the thing, right? Yeah. So I think this really starts with asking what the users value and why they're coming to your product in the first place, whether it's a game or whether it's an app with playful elements to it, and then trying to align your bottom line with the user's actual value. Mm-hmm. Because if you feel like you're adding a feature to make a game more addictive that isn't adding anything to the gameplay or adding anything to the core, but is like a tacked on extra engagement system, chances are that you're triggering anxiety or addictive patterns.
Yeah.
Right. Which will not make your user feel good, but might make them play the game. And then eventually when they do churn, they will be disgruntled and they might talk about, you know, feeling manipulated by what you've built. Which in the long term might not be good for your success.
Yeah. Right. And you're not going to be able to capture that necessarily with analytics until maybe it's too late.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I want to highlight something because I encounter this a fair bit in my work, and I don't know how many game designers know this, but the fact that external motivation isn't just you get a reward for doing something that you want, like, hey, you do this, you get a cookie. It is also the avoidance of punishment. So that idea of if I don't clean my room, I will lose my phone. If I don't study, I will get a bad grade. If I don't do this thing, I will miss out. Like that idea of FOMO can also, fear of missing out, can also be the quote unquote punishment.
Right.
And that's something that isn't oftentimes the first thing we think of when we think of external motivation. Mm. We usually think about things like high scores, you know, get a bonus gift, get the rank, top rank thing.
Yeah.
It can be meaningless to some, or it could be a real social status thing, but the real insidiousness is if I don't do this, then something bad will happen. And that kind of fear behind that compulsion, I guess.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think Snapchat's a good example. The way they use airflakes. Why am I talking to a person on Snapchat? Well, hopefully it's because I like them and I'm getting something out of my conversations with them, daily or near daily. But then they develop this streak, which encourages you to send snaps, which is like the core of Snapchat. And you don't just have a streak on Snapchat. You have a streak with everyone you know on Snapchat.
What? I haven't used Snapchat in years. And I didn't know this.
I don't use it myself. I find it a little childish, but as soon as you've talked to somebody for 3 days in a row on Snapchat, it begins a streak.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And that streak becomes a symbol of your relationship with this person. And if you don't send a snap on a given day, you lose your streak.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But if you do lose your streak, you can pay to restore it.
What?
And this is how Snapchat...
I didn't know that part. Ooh,
that's rough. Wow.
This is how Snapchat monetizes. Oh, okay. And there's no way to pause the streak.
Yeah.
So let's say you go on vacation or you lose your phone, or more likely your parents grounded you and took your phone. You cannot maintain your streak anymore and you can't pause it. So either you're paying to restore it, or what people are doing is giving their logins to friends who then log in on their account on another device which is completely insecure and puts your data at risk, your private conversations at risk, in order to maintain this streak. Well, why? Like, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. It's you like the thought of like, I like talking to my friends is way out the window at this point.
Yeah.
And it's totally about this compulsive, I don't want to lose my streak. It's, you know, it's at 900 days. If I lose it, this will happen. I'll feel bad. So you're acting out of anxiety and fear of loss, not out of the value that the product promised in the first place.
Yeah. Hey, Mark.
Uh-huh.
I have a horse and I need to clothe it so that way everyone knows that I'm better than them.
I see where this is going. I don't know if I can help you, but let's follow this fantasy all the way to the end. What have you tried so far?
I tried a coffee cup, a decorative mug, and it fell off.
Uh-huh.
I tried a bumper sticker, but it fell off.
Yeah, okay.
Because apparently horses have hair.
I might have tried that. Yeah,
that would work.
Well, if you also want to fail at this task, you can do that by going to nicegames.club/merch, where we have a couple of items you can give it your best shot.
Yeah.
Including a very soft t-shirt.
Yes.
A throw pillow.
Yes.
Which, you know... No, that one's not going to work, but give it a try.
Yeah.
And of course, our incredible game Glom.
Yeah.
That we designed here on the program, which you can, you know, you can see how the horse does.
Yeah.
It's a word game, but you know, everyone deserves a shot.
Yeah.
My horse does have a very high streak on Puzmo, so maybe it would like.
Yeah, go to nicegames.club/merch and buy a t-shirt, I guess.
I do want to take a peel an onion layer back on this, because the sort of example you gave earlier of like, you know, thinking about implementing a streak is Duolingo. It's like, oh, let's follow that model.
Yeah.
And I think I've heard from people who use Duolingo and other types of learning apps that use streak mechanics, and that anxiety is there. Mm. That feeling of I'm only doing this because it's this sort of like unnatural impulse rather than my actual goal, which is to learn the thing. But in that case, I think you could argue that it's like a cigarette tax, where it's like it's we do this, so it's good for you, and like and we motivate your lizard brain in service of a larger goal. So I think when we talk about like checking ourselves as developers, I think it's you can have debate on this, but like, is there a time where basically as a developer, you want UI to be, or UX to be intuitive, understandable, but at the same time, we're magicians. We use smoke and mirrors. The whole, all game design is tricks.
Yes.
And so, is there, like, I don't know that I'm that upset about Duolingo, for example, because even though it might impart those same sort of negative responses like all streak mechanics do, I think people might need that if their actual goal is to learn a language rather than get a high score in a thing. So like, where's that line?
So I would ask, are they learning a language?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, but is that better than just trusting that they will? Like, like, is it in service? Like, you know, high cigarette taxes don't cause everyone to quit smoking.
Right.
And I'm not defending these. This is morally just playing devil's advocate.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that just as it's likely to be like, well, if I don't charge people money for this exploitative behavior, it's not exploitative. I think likewise is like this sort of this smoke and mirrors trickery, you know, can be used for good because you're not in full conversation with the player about how your design works.
Yeah.
Because that's no player wants that.
Right.
And also that makes your game bad.
Yeah.
If you explain how everything works and give them like, you know, please check this box to be okay with this game mechanic.
Yeah.
Now, you know, so maybe there are places for you to trick a player. Mm. Maybe this isn't it.
This actually does kind of lean into kind of how I've started thinking about things in my own work from this talk, but I want you to first give your thoughts.
Yeah, Duolingo is an interesting case, not just because it's the most famous one, but also because like they kind of invented the science of it and understand like how it works and why so well. And I think most people on Duolingo understand the purpose of the streak, mm-hmm. And how it's a way to help keep them responsible and feel proud of their achievements. And Duolingo's streak also does link up well one-to-one with the value, because if I have a high Duolingo streak, that means that I'm a dedicated learner, right? That's like, that's how the value is communicated. You can also pause a Duolingo streak. You can freeze it. You can recover it. It is easy to do that without paying. Or at least the last time I used it was, you can earn streaks and spend points on things, right? That you never had to use currency for. So as far as streak mechanics go, I don't think Duolingo is the worst offender. Mm-hmm. That said, how does Duolingo make its money? Number one, through ads.
Yeah.
If you're a free user, which wasn't always the case, but is now. So they need users not to churn. They need users to stick on the app. The longer they're on the app, the better. Second, by a premium upsell, which gets rid of the ads and unlimits things a bit for you. And every, like, just like some other games we were talking about a little bit ago, every miniature on the app is an opportunity for them to upsell you, yeah, and show you're mad, right? Duolingo does not make money when you learn a language or improve in language. They make money when you touch your phone and look at it.
Yeah. Right, right.
So,
which is a proxy for learning a language. It could be argued, like, are the incentives aligned, or is it a really dangerous environment for exploitation?
Yeah,
like it's case by case, I guess, for these different applicants. You have to trust the company to implement it correctly, I suppose.
And I think, like, vanishingly few people have become fluent in a language through Duolingo,
yeah,
where they could go to Haiti and have a conversation in French with a native there because they use Duolingo.
Yeah,
I think it's a good way to practice while you're taking a class or something like that. But at the end of the day, like, Duolingo doesn't do better when you learn more. They do better when you're on the app longer.
Right, mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yeah.
And their incentive is to keep you on the app forever.
Yeah, yeah.
Not kick you once you've learned the language.
Yeah. I think to speak specifically to Duolingo, I want to do this, and then I'm really curious on your thoughts, Lydia, on this.
Mm-hmm.
To speak specifically to Duolingo, I did use Duolingo for like a year or something, yeah, before a pandemic to try to learn Japanese.
I remember this.
Yeah.
And you had troubles, right?
I just kept getting the same words over and over again, and I was realizing that, like, I'm not actually learning anything. I'm just reinforcing a few of the words that they kept feeding back to me. And then I was like, this is a waste of my time. And I would do it as I was walking to work at the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a waste of time, but like, I just felt like I wasn't actively learning anything.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are potentially patterns to use a streak to like be beneficial to, but I don't think the Duolingo is a good example.
I wonder if that just more proves the limits of a low cost, low complexity learning environment, whereas that's maybe the best you could hope for, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Or if it's just like, oh, it could be a lot better, and those mechanics actually make it not as good as it could be.
Yeah, I don't know.
You know,
yeah.
So that's tough to know.
Mm-hmm. Lydia, what are your thoughts?
So for me, it really, the question is, does it beget other exploitative things?
Okay.
So the yes, you could have and benefit from a streak, and some people, their brains just love it. And that is how they get to do things, is if they wake up and they're like, I'm not breaking the streak, whatever that is for them. If you have a severe punishment for losing the streak, even if it's not literal, but it, like a perceived punishment, or you make it seem like a big deal.
Yeah.
Or if you have some form of something you have to do in order to get it back, whether it's monetary or otherwise, or if the act of fulfilling the streak is in some way exploitative or predatory. So for example, when it comes to thinking about, okay, well, if we ever wanted to employ streaks at work in our the arcades platform, that how would we do that? Because this is a platform for training, specifically, pretty much like for work. If we have streaks, What happens if you get sick? What happens if you have a holiday?
Yeah.
What happens, and like, how are we going to count the streak? Because if it's daily, then that means we are implying that you should come in on, log in on the weekend into your workplace thing and play a game for your work when you're not being paid for it. Is there, what if you have leave coming up?
Yeah.
All of those things, you know, you have to kind of trying to follow the thread on, well, what are we implying if we have this, and if it's if itself is not exploitative, the things around it, or how it feeds into other things that could be exploitative.
Yeah, and if you want to pause the streak or have that, you know, to account for all those scenarios and let the user be in control of that, if the point of a streak is a proxy for like learning, then like pausing a streak could, you know, to go on leave for 2 weeks, and not then you're not tracking the loss of learning that comes from that. But then it's all, so it the further away from a one-to-one relationship between testing whether you understood the task, or whether it's it particularly for language game or for learning games. You could like, well, we want to be nice to the user, but the point of this was to encourage them to stay with it. And if we let them, so it's like, it's where's the line on both sides, right?
I will also say it is an imperfect measure, and I think some of it's because of the medium. It's, you know, programming data, and it is also an imperfect measure because people are imperfect. There's a trend that I've seen online that I actually think is really good, where people illustrate black and white thinking. There's the idea of, you know, well, if I mess up, then the whole day is shot. So they'll like spill a little bit of water, and then they'll go just completely upend their cup onto the counter because, like, well, if they've spilled a little water, fuck it. It's all on the counter now. That's how people act.
Yeah.
And also,
we don't let things be fuzzy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, it doesn't capture the nuance of what continuing a streak could be. So if your streak is exercising, it may be a rest day is part of your streak because your muscles need that.
Yes.
Yeah.
But if your streak is determined by, did you log, like tap your card into the gym and do this many steps on the treadmill for whatever your, you know, your personal streak is, well, then it's, you've lost it. Mm. Right. Yeah. But it doesn't have that nuance that, it doesn't have that nuance, and it can't have that nuance built in the same way that it can't register whether you logging into Duolingo is you just putting your eyeballs on the app, or if it's you actually gaining competency in the language.
Yeah, and the more robust you make the system, the less abstract it is, and then it becomes a lot less valuable, a lot less useful.
Yeah.
Right.
Does that sound fair, I guess?
It does, yeah. And there's some behavioral science about this that that enlightens it a little bit. So what you're describing, Lydia, is a commonly known kind of like behavioral bias. Like you picture a person that is on a diet or whatever, and then they ate a cookie, Oreo. And it's like, well, I already ate an Oreo, so I'm not on my diet anymore. So fuck it, I'll eat the entire sleeve, right? Yeah. And this is something that happens pretty frequently. And the same thing happens, right? You miss a day of something, it's a lot easier to miss the next day of it. Yeah. Right. It's everyone listening to this has probably done this in their life.
It's a weird thing where like a streak should encourage the idea of something's better than nothing, but breaking the streak encourages the opposite.
Yeah.
It's demoralizing. Like when the streak breaks, you're like, ah, oh well. It's like back in the day when video games didn't have saving, I'm like,
oh yeah, you
get really, really far and then die, and then you missed a checkpoint or something, and like you end up like 40 minutes of gameplay in the past, and you're like, oh my god,
well, I'm done, like, with this game.
Is gone, right?
And yet that's the entire mechanic of Blueprints.
You just don't. Okay.
We'll talk about it later.
Uh-huh. You just don't like roguelikes. Go in your corner.
But yeah, so there's like a debate whether like, okay, who's better at achieving their goals? The person that never, ever, ever, ever misses, mm-hmm. no matter what, And that's what we should encourage, because these are the people that succeed. Or is the person that forgives themselves for messing up, or is willing to give themselves a break, but then actually restarts instead of falling off.
Yeah.
And I think the majority of people are not perfect. In fact, no one is.
Right.
So building forgiveness into your system and making sure that it's framed that way is really, really important if you want somebody to stick with something, as opposed to holding their hand to the fire in an emergency way. No, you can't mess up. You can't mess up.
That's a quantity versus quality kind of thing, right? It's hard to capture in analytics people being properly, like truly engaged in your work when it's easier to both engineer and track a larger amount of shallow engagement.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Yes. Like these vanity metrics, like time on app, and you know, churn rates and things like that, that don't measure delivering value. They measure, eyeballs on a screen, which is easier to sell to like a funder or a board member or whatever. And easier to measure, frankly, than value delivery.
Yeah, I this is something I wanted to talk about. And I think that you brought it up, Sam, in that like there are these patterns in games that are difficult to avoid. But I think that like we as developers have a responsibility to allow players the agency to skip something if they don't want to do it or something's come up.
Yeah.
So like for example, the streaks thing, there's different ways that people go about, like you can pause the streak if you're going to go on vacation or whatever. I've been thinking about Puzmo, because Puzmo has those streaks, and like when we went to GDC, I didn't do Puzmo all that week. and then I came back, and I hate missing the streak in Puzmo, and this is part of the problem, I guess. When you miss the streak in Puzmo, if you just start a new streak for 7 days, you will get your old streak back.
Oh, hey.
It advertises that to you.
Yes, it does. It tells you that.
And I hate that.
Oh, you hate that. Yeah.
I play Puzmo every day.
Yes.
Because I want to play it.
Right.
I don't need to see that my streak is like 60% of all
the days. Oh, I agree.
And I'll never, I want that out of my face.
It's kind of.
Like, I really hate it.
Sure.
But it sounds like it's an affordance. It sounds like it's a good thing they're giving users to reclaim it.
Yeah.
I disagree. I think that's awful.
Well, what I wanted to say
yes.
is that like I think it's important for us to allow for players to have these kinds of affordances, to have potentially off ramps so that like they're not playing Stardew Valley for 10,000 hours. If they feel like they've invested a lot of time and they want to stop, they're giving them some kind of a concrete ending. I mean, Stardew Valley does have an ending, so that's the kind of the responsibility there. Yeah. But like in general, I think that it's important for us as developers to consider the player in these kinds of things. And I'm curious, Sam, if you have considerations that you would recommend, or even just like thoughts as to how to go about it to best help developers guide players towards safe decisions.
Yeah, so something that people usually neglect during user testing is asking these questions of the user that are focused around their like state of safety.
Okay.
Right? With their state of comfort.
Yeah.
For instance, like certain features that might feel pressuring or bad to certain users, like leaderboards, social sharing, social comparison, things like that.
Yeah.
The streaks, whatever. When the user is using these, I think it's worthwhile to ask them, well, how do they feel about it? Like, would you like to be able to opt out of some of these?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
you can't opt out of the streak in Puzmo.
No. They do let you opt out of certain things.
Oh, okay.
But they're still very enticing.
Yes.
And they've made changes recently to really diminish global leaderboards.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is great, because I actually made a stink about it on their Discord when they started, of like, this is like, I don't need this. Like, it's not a healthy motivation.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody agreed with me, because it just seemed very normal and fine. But they, after a year plus of them doing it, I think they've found that, no, it's better just to like compare yourself with your friends, mm-hmm. not with the five best players in the world every day.
Yeah.
You know, because that's just awful.
Just give me puzzles.
Sorry to interrupt.
Totally. But yeah, like asking questions like actually prompting them to reply whether they're feeling anxious about anything.
Yeah.
Whether they're being worried about anything, whether they're confused about the values of things, right? And then figuring out how to reduce those negative pressures and enhance the things that make them kind of genuinely enjoy playing or using the product.
I like that framing because like those are the kinds of things we ask players already, but not in that same way. Like we're interested in making sure that players are having fun, but we're not necessarily, maybe we're not asking why they're having fun or what specifically is working about the design that compels people to keep playing.
Yeah. Well, this is why Puzmo is a good example because like they have a community, they've started to ask those questions and it's a living, you know, it's designed to evolve. And so not everyone works that way, right? Or not every game works that way.
Yeah.
You do your testing before launch and then now you're trapped in a business model.
Yeah.
And that is determining your choices, even if you could collect the data, then you probably won't.
Yeah.
So it's, I guess it's probably important to also know that like you can get better at this.
Mm-hmm.
As you build your game and even after you release it.
Yeah.
I mean, I would like people to steer clear of these minefields, but if you're near one, like, you know, the learning doesn't stop once the game is done, you know.
The learning doesn't stop when the streak ends.
Right. There you go. Yeah.
On the topic of ending, I'm curious if there is a behavioral science concept for that idea of realizing that something isn't serving you anymore and stopping, because that takes a lot of mindfulness that most people don't have. And it often, I mean, I've had conversations with people realizing like, oh yeah, I stopped, like I realized I was just grinding and I wasn't actually having fun, or it wasn't getting me to the fun parts fast enough. So I stopped playing.
Yeah.
But and that also then, you know, feeds into this idea of, well, why are you doing something and how able are you to stop? Is there a behavioral science concept to describe like that phenomenon? And when it comes to figuring out where and how your game should end, how can we kind of hold those things in mind when developing our games? Because I mean, there is a lot to be gained from repeatable games. That's why we like roguelikes. But if you're not aiming for that, or if you don't need to, or you think it's not going to serve your game, how do you find that point before people either hit compulsion or they just give up? Because that's the other side. If they may just go, I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
And then that leaves a bad taste in their mouth in a different way.
Right.
Shallow game mechanics can't capture a person forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At the end of the day, if somebody is continuing to use product or service or game, whatever it happens to be, they need to be getting like some real value from it. And if they're not, they will lose their motivation to continue, which is what you're describing, Lydia. And I don't know if there's a behavioral science term to that type of quitting, but basically it's just a loss of motivation.
Yeah, yeah.
I think a good framework to look at for this is the HexAd framework of motivation. And basically the idea is that there's, you know, the author has laid out six different types of motivation, right? Between like philanthropy, which might be helping others, like social connection, socializing. It could be, you know, exploring and discovering. And there's a few others, you know, I don't have them all, you know, on the tip of my tongue, but the last one is kind of, I forget what he calls it, maybe an innovator or someone like that. But basically it means that if you don't give them something to do with their energy, they will use the energy to destroy what you've made.
Oh,
right. Like these are the people that in a game start, using like griefing behaviors, or hacking,
oh, I know
or
like that, yeah,
yeah, like the kid that defaces the slide instead of sliding down it.
Yeah.
But people start a game and they want to play it, so they want to know how to win it, So they figure out how to win it and they start doing the behaviors that help them win the game.
Right.
But then that only stays interesting for so long. Then I have to move into another lane. So that lane could be like talking to other people on the forums and becoming maybe a leader on those forums. It could be like attaining complete mastery.
Yeah.
Mm. Right. The people that want 100% things. It could be, finding a way to experiment and explore and create, like on Minecraft, where you learn more and more ways to create and build things that you never imagined before, and you get to be really creative. And if you can't channel a user into one of these kind of productive pursuits, they'll either churn or become like a problem in your system.
Yeah. Okay. I definitely wouldn't have thought of it in that way. Like the person turning so sour in the game that they start actively wanting it gone in a way.
I mean, there's a healthier side of that coin, which is like speedrunning.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Which is once you've exhausted the game's potential, you invent new things to do.
Oh, sure. I would argue that's within the innovator.
Well, sure, but what I'm saying is that that's a healthy expression of
that.
Yeah. Right. That's true, yeah. Okay.
These things can be channeled.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, that's true.
Or you build your own mods or like things that, even though Nintendo might not want you to do it, are actually pretty positive.
Yeah, okay. That's a good... And I guess to circle back a bit on the question you were asking, Lydia, one of the things that I want to better understand, at least in my own words, is like making sure that a player is capable of recognizing when they're no longer interested in the game and allowing them the freedom to stop playing and feel comfortable with that before they play it to the point of exhaustion where they start souring on the game.
Yeah,
because you were saying, Lydia, like that becomes, if you play the game to the point where like you can't stand it anymore and you don't realize that, oh, wait, I actually don't like this part anymore and I want to just stop, then that will, as a motivator for a developer, that will mean that, like, you'll have bad word of mouth, and that's bad.
Yeah.
But also, just, like, you don't want people to have a bad impression of your game after a long time playing it. I'm curious how developers can create a system to allow players to recognize that in themselves, recognize when they're done with the game, actively know it, and then give them the power to stop playing.
So I think to a company or a game developer, like there's no risk to having a player end the game and leave.
Yeah.
If they've already paid you everything they're going to pay, right? And
monetary perspective, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Then you got to worry about Steam reviews.
Yeah, there's also Steam reviews.
Well, and you want them to leave with a good taste in their mouth.
Yes,
for sure.
Right? You want to give them that positive experience. Yes. And a lot of single-player games are like this. There is a risk if you're an online multiplayer game.
Yeah.
Because if people leave, then there's nobody to play with.
Yes.
So players show up to an empty room.
Mm-hmm.
So it's less advantageous or desirable to a game developer to give off-roads to people that are playing games that are online multiplayer.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. What do you do in that case? You need to come up with healthy mechanics or healthy like patterns that make a player want to keep coming back without churning, that don't exploit them.
Yeah.
Puffing up the crack.
Yeah.
Let me know if this is a wild idea, but I'm wondering if a lot of this is like a cultural thing too. Like if you're building if there was a culture in the game that like, cause like a game, I don't think that the game can necessarily, it should be responsible for a person's mental health, but it can't do everything. I'm wondering if there's a way to like cultivate a culture that helps players off ramp themselves, or maybe like transition into like a mentorship or something instead of like the quote unquote doers who are playing the game a lot.
I think the question is about like, what is the responsibility of a game or game developer to their players,
yeah,
and safeguarding mental health. Clearly there's some responsibility to be ethical and not exploit them.
Right.
I think players kind of would resent having the game or the developers telling them that they know better than you do.
Sure.
How you should spend time.
That's a good point.
Right. Like, I think there's something like trusting the players,
yeah,
to do what they think is best for themselves. Mm-hmm. I think is good too. As long as you're not, you know, saying that out of one corner of your mouth and out of the other, you know, behind closed doors, like figuring out how to addict them to it.
Oh, for
right?
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, having people enter mentorship roles is good. And I think people do that naturally if mm-hmm. you give them the infrastructure to do that,
yeah,
and communicate to each other. I think one way that companies kind of like recapture people that might be thinking about churning is by just giving them more content.
Mm-hmm.
And creating events around it, and like special seasonal events and special events are some of the most popular patterns out there to get people to stick to something. This helps them not get bored.
Yeah.
And makes them feel like they don't want to miss out.
Yeah.
Yes, that's FOMO, right? And it can be an anxious thing. Like everyone else is on this, doing this thing. I should be there too. But if what you're showing them is something good and exciting that they want to play,
yeah,
then I think there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
Players are, I think, pretty good at making entertainment choices for themselves.
Yeah.
Mm. Overall, and I don't think that's what developers need to be worried about. I think they just need to be making sure that they're not unknowingly, I'm being charitable, unknowingly copying addictive patterns and exploitative patterns and putting them in their games for capture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We all know that many people are doing it knowingly and deliberately and don't care what happens because they need their whales that pay $10,000.
Right.
In the positive impact space, a lot of time there's the kind of constant joke of, you know, the client that comes and said, hey, can you make it like Fortnite? And there's a lot of also the language around, you know, calling something an addictive gameplay loop or calling something right. an addictive game.
Yeah.
And using that as a shorthand for what they actually want, which is they want someone interested and engaged and they want someone to return to it. But they don't actually want it to be addictive because then they're not actually doing it for a love of what it is or interest in what it is. And then they're not leaving it to then apply those skills they've learned from the game.
Right.
It's just that it is a lazy term that is captured in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of it is not malicious. It is out of lack of understanding in term of what it actually implies. Mm-hmm. And it's out of, you know, well, we want it to be popular. We want it to be these things. What's popular? This and what's successful? If you don't think by what metric?
Yeah.
It's being measured and deemed successful. Or is that even what we want? That's where that, you know, we have to give that charity, but also have to start thinking about it. You know, what do you actually want from the game, the players, yourselves?
Right. Those are the important kind of questions. And I think that a lot of this, kind of from what I've gotten a lot from this topic as we're winding down, I think is that like a lot of it is the motivation of the developer, why you're doing it. Like, mm-hmm. I think we as developers have a responsibility to take care of our players. And if you are sacrificing some of that care to make more money, I mean, that's bad. I think that like that is, if you're also sacrificing that care, so players continue to play it and keep talking about it and almost feel forced and compelled to play it, that's also bad. I think that like, if they feel compelled to play it because they're enjoying the game a lot, and maybe it's become like a part of their routine because it's an enjoyable aspect of it, like Puzzmo, for instance. I think that's fine, but I think that like, yeah, it's important to just like take stock of why you're doing this, and what you want from the game and what you want players to experience, because that is a lot of what I think ends up fueling some of these patterns.
Mm-hmm.
As not an expert, that's what.
Yeah, let's give Sam the last word
yes.
on this, because I think we've covered a lot.
Yes, we have.
It is it's like we're like, oh, okay, design patterns, dark patterns, such a specific topic.
Yes.
But it really goes everywhere.
Right.
Covers a lot of different things.
Would you say that everything is everything?
I would say that repeatedly again and again. But Sam, tell us sort of, is there a summation you can give that is satisfying, or is it that you can't give a satisfying summation of this topic?
Yeah, so I think there's plenty of writing on this topic for people to go and dig into. I think one thing to know is being aware of them doesn't really protect you from them.
Yeah.
Just because you know how the trick is done, it doesn't mean that you can't be fooled by it.
Right.
And like we talk about addiction, and I think the most addictive games out there are gambling games. Mm-hmm. And you know, to the point where people like need to be treated for addiction to them. And I want to make sure that there's a distinction between games like that and games that just have a really strong gameplay loop.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like I'm playing this game a lot because I naturally want to keep playing it. Not because if I don't play it, I start becoming obsessed with it. Right.
Yeah.
Like you would if you were addicted to gambling. And there's a story that I read in a book called Addiction by Design about this woman who was addicted to slot machines. And so she decided to become a slot machine technician because she felt that if she understood how the things worked, that she could break the spell over her. But she ended up, there was a sample machine in the training room, and she would end up playing that on her breaks.
Mm.
So what makes it addictive, or what makes it exploitative, isn't like some secret. It's like a well-known psychological pattern that works if you have the personality to be addicted to it and expose yourself to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like if you're a game developer out there and you're worried that people are spending too much time on your games or something like that, just stop and think, well, why? Like, why are they on it? Why are they playing it?
Yeah.
Are they playing it because they feel, because they really, they're in the flow state and they really feel like when they're playing it, they're becoming a good version of themselves?
Yeah.
Of doing things that they're proud of, their accomplishments and exploring and being creative and spending time with friends? Or are they playing your game because there's some addictive pattern or you're producing anxiety in them? So I guess that's my advice to devs out there.
That's why you asked the expert.
Yeah.
That's a better way of saying what I was saying.
Yeah.
That's our show. You can find Sam online at LinkedIn, on Medium at sa-liberty, and at samliberty.com. For those links in the show notes from today's conversation, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode or others or whatever with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.